Turn that on?
Yeah,
so. Okay. Everybody got, okay, everybody. Hi, everybody. I'm Robin. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm happy you all made it here. I come here talking. Okay, we're going to start now. Welcome to the step study workshop, steps 1, 2, and 3. I'm glad you came. So, let's have a meditation about a minute preceding the Serenity Prayer. John, Seppi, and Ira will share their experience, strength, and hope on how they got through the steps abstinently. Each speaker will talk for 20 minutes, 18 minutes, plus 2-minute warning. As a courtesy to the meeting, please check to see that all cell phones and other electronic devices are turned off. That's actually literal, so don't leave them on. Turn them off. Appreciate it. Thank you. Our first speaker will be John K. on step one.
Oh, okay. Already?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, I didn't know if we had any readings or anything. Okay. My name is John. I'm a compulsive eater. Those of you who just heard me share at Kitchen Sink, I promise I won't do the same thing. It'll be a different life. No, I won't be talking about that. I'll be talking more about step one and stuff. What I did mention at the meeting this morning, which is part of my story, I mean, just to qualify, I've been in program for 31 years. I have been abstinent for about 17, and the difference between those two numbers is had a lot to do with my not understanding step one, and it had a lot to do with my not understanding both powerlessness and not understanding the disease, in my opinion. For a long time, I mouthed the word powerless, I mouthed the word disease, but I didn't really get it in here. I didn't understand how this disease worked. I think there was a part of me that said, well, if you guys want to call it a disease and it makes you feel happy, fine. You know, but I don't think deep down I really did get it. I mean, I can tell you today, I at a core cellular level understand this is a disease. You know, it is not a physiological disease as much as a psychological disease, but they're finding out every year more and more and more about how these things aren't just, you know, transient things in our brains. You know, in the big book, there's a part of the big book where it talks about with alcoholism that there was a time we could take it or leave it, but then at a certain point we passed that invisible line. Well, that was stuff that we, you know, which just went from person to person in 1937 when this book was written, but they have now found there's an actual enzyme in the body called alcohol dehydrogenase, which burns out, and then people who used to be able to drink and put it down just cannot anymore. I happen to be one of those people. But the point is that year after year after year, they are finding out more about these diseases. You know, when OA first started, there was this big sort of, there was the gray sheet in the other sheet, the orange sheet, I think it was, you know, the whole idea about sugar and white flour, and everybody was like, you know, it was sort of seen, and then we start to now know about serotonin levels and about blood sugar spikes and things like that. So we do begin to understand more every day that it's a disease. And for me, that's an important thing. It makes me feel like I don't have to own this as a guilt thing. You know, people who have cancer don't sit there and go, I'm such a schmuck for getting cancer. You know, they get this is not anything they have control over. But when you're dealing with something like cancer, it's easier to understand or think about the fact that cancer is not, you know, part of the person. Yet, if you really look at it, those cancer cells are growing in that person. They are part of that person. But we can all certainly grasp the concept that that's not anything that person wanted, et cetera. But the trouble is that when you deal with a disease like we have, it's not about a growth you can point to. It's more about thoughts. Thoughts that are sabotaging us a lot of times, you know? I mean, imagine what it would be like if the disease of cancer had a component that told the victims of cancer, don't go to chemotherapy. You can do this yourself. You know, don't get radiation. You know, or as they're doing it, it'll talk them out of it. Well, that's sort of what happens with our disease. You know, I had 15, 16 years in this program, and yet in the middle of my slip, I couldn't get it. Incomprehensible demoralization. I was sharing today that I was the secretary at Artists in Abstinence, and I'm the secretary of a meeting, and I'm the delegate for a meeting, and I have a sponsor, and I'm sponsoring, and I'm doing all this stuff, and yet I would leave the meeting and go to the donut shop on the way home. And I'm leaving going, why am I doing this? Because I just couldn't understand, you know, how it worked. And I needed to understand that and to get it. And it's so hard because the disease is... He talks to me in the same voice that I hear everything else. I'm not saying I hear voices, you know. It's no, you know, kill the president kind of thing. It's more like, you know, you're driving down the street. Oh, I got to take a right here. Oh, I got to take a left here. Oh, here's a 7-Eleven. Go buy all the ice cream, you know. And what I got to hear is what it's telling me, because it sounds just like all the other thoughts in my head. And what I needed to realize is, you know, I want to be abstinent. I want recovery from this, or I wouldn't be doing all of this. You all wouldn't be sitting here now if you really just wanted to do it. Yet, if you end up in a relapse, there's a part of my disease. I always say my disease is like the world's best salesman. If you think of a salesman who is just good at, and you know how sales works. They get you to like them right away, and they're smooth, and they know how to say, and they compliment you, and they do all these wonderful things. Now imagine on top of all that, the disease can read your mind. So if the salesman can read your mind, so that no matter what you're going to say to that salesman as to why you shouldn't do it, he's got the answer. Well, that's what my disease does. My disease has always got a way that it convinces me, and that's why you can go do this today. This is why it'll be different, or whatever it needs to do. And the really evil thing about my disease is, on top of all of those things, if it does get me to go eat, to go relapse, it then whispers in my ear, and by the way, you know, this was your idea, you know. And as a way for me to not understand and individuate the disease from me, and that's what makes it so hard. And we need, I think, an important part of this disease is to acknowledge how hard it can be. You know, I'm in the other program, 31 years of sobriety, and in my opinion, this is just me, I think it took me a year to get sober. But it was 10 times easier to get sober than it was to get abstinent. But it's 1,000 times easier to stay sober than it is to stay abstinent. Because I don't have to be around alcohol. I had a mother who stopped drinking 30 years before she passed away, but didn't work the steps, didn't have any kind of what I would call sobriety I would want a part of. But she hit a hard enough bottom. She was 65. She didn't have to be around alcohol, and she never drank again. We have the food there every day. It's in our face, literally, but figuratively too. And we have to deal with it. And again, it's not like alcohol that you can just cut out. I always find it interesting that the words sobriety and abstinence, in my opinion, are flipped around. We don't abstain from eating. You know, we have to find a way to eat soberly. Alcoholics abstain from drinking alcohol. Yes, I know that the idea is that, you know, as a recovering alcoholic will drink, you know, have a soda or an orange juice or whatever, but it's been a long, long time since any of that triggered me at all. I mean, right when I stopped drinking because I drank screwdrivers, I had to stop drinking orange juice for a real short time. But that long ago went away. And, you know, so the thing that I needed to do is I needed to understand, first of all, what I was going to be surrendering to. You know, in other words, if I'm just saying I'm powerless over food, which is the way they use it in the step, it's really not true. I am not powerless over Brussels sprouts. I guarantee you, I have never gone on a Brussels sprout binge in my life. I am not powerless over liver. I haven't eaten liver since I was able to move out of my mother's house. But there are foods. There are foods that I cannot eat like a gentleman. And the hardest thing is, my disease wants to, well, you know, you can sort of do it. You just got to be a little careful. It will find, but to me, my disease looks for anything it can grab to kick the can down the road on getting me to give up all the foods that I shouldn't be eating. And it will whisper perfectly good program expressions to me. You know, oh, well, today, why don't you just work on praying for willingness? I mean, when I was in the middle of my binge, I think I said that at like every meeting for like a 2 months. I'm praying for the willingness to stop, you know. And I remember I was at some like convention or something, and I heard a woman get up and led, and she said, you know, when it comes to addiction, willingness is highly overrated. You know, if Bill and Dr. Bob had waited until they were willing to stop drinking, there would never have been a program, because it came down to having the pain. You know, and again, I was sharing today that one of the things that makes this disease hard also, in my opinion, is the way in which it delivers the pain. Because the pain isn't like alcoholism and drug, where you have acute pain. You have things happen and that slam you face down into the pavement and pick up your bloody face, and your disease is like, get it. You know? And then if you have a moment of clarity, you can realize, my God, what am I doing with my life? But our disease delivers slow, chronic pain that makes you uncomfortable enough to want to change, but often not uncomfortable enough to be willing to go to any lengths to change. And so that's what makes it so hard, is that we have to find a way to accept that. And I was sharing, and I'm sorry if some of you guys who heard this morning, in the middle of this whole time when I was slipping and sliding, I'd be at every meeting, I'm powerless over food, and then I'd go eat. And then I'd come back, I'm powerless, and I eat. And I, you know, I'm powerless, and I eat. Now, did I say when I was going out, well, that's it, screw OA, I'm not coming back, obviously it doesn't work? No, there was a part of me that when I really looked at it and did writing, I had a sponsor have me write on it, I was saying, when I'm done with this binge, I will come back and I will start over. And part of the reason I said that to myself is I had done it over and over and over. And I would get 2 months, I'd get 6 months, I'd get a year. And the part of that is, how can I sit there and say out loud I'm powerless over the food when inside I have empirical evidence to the contrary? And part of it is that it was how I saw the word powerlessness. Because in my alcoholism, if I pick up a drink, one drink, I guarantee you could put all the linebackers in the NFL between me and drink number two, and then put all the supermodels in the world, I'm going past all of them, and I'm going to get that drink. But with food, it's different, you know? And I did have periods of being able to stay abstinent. And I think part of it is when I had it in my brain that, you know what, I've done this before, and if I have to, I know how to stop this train. Even if it's hard, I may have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, I may have to go get a new sponsor, I may have to write like crazy, but eventually I will get abstinent again. And the trouble is, I did. And what that told me in here was, I am powerful over the food. But the trouble was, I never pulled the camera back enough to see the real answer. And I remember right near the end of one of my last binges, when I went out for the umpteenth time, I was sitting there going, I had 3 weeks, and why did I blow it again? And I remember every once in a while thoughts come into my head that I really, you know, again, I'm not an overthumper about higher power, but every once in a while thoughts come into my head that I go, where'd that come from? And I really think maybe the higher power. And I'm going, why did I do that again? And a little voice said, well, you know, maybe you haven't been abstinent since you first came in, since you first picked up after you were abstinent for a long time. And I got thinking about that. And I got thinking about, I needed to change how I saw powerlessness. Because if I look at it in the short, small picture, I can convince myself I am powerful. But if I pull back, you know that great scene from Gone with the Wind when the nurse is working on the wounded guy and the camera just keeps panning back and back and back and back, and eventually you get to what they call in film an establishing shot. That's what I needed to see. I needed to see the establishing shot of my powerlessness, which is that as long as I am making food an option, you know, it's going to be the only option. It's going to be the path of least resistance. Because who is going to want to have to go through whatever it is that drove me out? In other words, I didn't just like, oh, I'm going to go eat. Would be something happen? I would be some emotional or turmoil or something. And if you have a choice between emotional turmoil and eating something that you like, and that tastes good, and that at least at one point in your life, it certainly wasn't working very much by the time I finally did get absent, but it did something to me at one point, it's a no-brainer. And what I had to finally get to was the point of saying, you know what, food just can't be an option anymore. And that is easier said than done. The other problem, I think, with this disease is it just keeps pounding away. I, you know, 31 years, and it's still pounding on the door every day. Now, it does it a lot more subtly than it used to, and it does it with different things, but, I mean, just recently I had to look at some of the foods I was eating and realize I wasn't binging on them. I was certainly within my boundaries, but they were taking up a huge part of my life, way more than any food should. And that to me was a sign I was doing some controlled eating as opposed to abstinence. And I had to look at that. And it's a little part that decision making where I need to have help, you know. And it'll be talked about more, but this whole idea with the steps, I believe I was taught from people who I think knew more than me, that if you do the steps right, there's a smooth transition from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. And if you have a problem, go back one. That's what I was always taught. But that I needed to have outside help. You know, I needed to have a higher power. Now, I do have, you know, I came in as a raving atheist, and that's for the next step, but I did find some kind of a higher power. But for me, I'm a big believer in a hierarchy of higher power. I was sharing today that I need to have a sponsor. I need to have a sponsor who I talk to and talk about some of these things, because, you know, the joke I've always made is me and God can go into a closet and I'll pray and come out thinking that chocolate's a vegetable, you know, and then God told me chocolate was a vegetable, and then I call my sponsor and he goes, nah, not today, you know. But that's just the point, is that, and you know, that I don't know, and I think a lot of us don't know what is the real voice of God. And what is the voice of my disease just doing a really good God impression? You know, and that for me today, I need to work these steps in such a way where I do all of that, you know. And just going to look at some notes here. You know, the whole idea of me saying I'm powerless. I would always say I'm powerless, you know. I always think to myself, I have really got in my core soul, I am powerless over a bullet in a gun. You know why? Because I've never put a gun to my head, and as I'm pulling the trigger, say, I'll start again on Monday. You know, I get that's powerless, right? And I could not see that with the food. I always thought somewhere down the way, you know, and I have examples out there, not good examples. I mean, a lot of us know there was a guy in program who we all loved who died a few years ago, and he had... Here's the thing. I also talk about the fact that I buried 2 sponsees in this program. I'm buried in ENA, buried in here, in these programs. And what really scares me sometimes about that is both of the guys I buried and this other guy who we know, I won't mention names, but yeah, a lot of us know this guy who passed away a few years ago, is it wasn't like these guys didn't have it. They had been abstinent. They had gotten abstinent, and they gave it up, and they're dead now. And I know that when they went out, they didn't say, hey, I'm going to go out, and then I'm going to start slipping and sliding, and then I'm going to strip away from OA altogether, and then I'm going to die. There was a part of them, just for today, I'm going to do this. And I know that, and I have lots of good reasons to stay abstinent, but sometimes a little fear isn't the worst thing in the world, to say, you know, there, but for the grace of God. He had abstinence, just like I have abstinence. There's nothing, I don't have a special abstinence gland in my body that says, oh, well, I can never go out again, and therefore I have to watch that. And the part of that is staying teachable, and to be, and that, a lot of this came later, you know, the whole idea of working these things. The first 3 steps are really about, you know, getting the food down and keeping it down. But I also know that working these other steps that have to do with me working on my character defects, which I don't like the phrase. I like the phrase defense mechanisms. They did something for me at one point, or I wouldn't have done them. But that's also how my disease tries to get in a side door later. You know, I am an immature person. I mean, my 2 things are immaturity and narcissism, and my disease will find a way in because my immaturity says, well, I should be able to, I was talking to somebody after the meeting this morning about how one of my big things is like, well, I have a sponsor, you can eat this thing. Well, I can't. And there's a little 5-year-old in there goes, well, if he can have that, I want to have that. And if he can have that, I want to have that. And what I got to realize is, and this is where it's also difficult, is it's really simple over in AA. You don't drink alcohol. You know, there aren't some people in AA who drink beer and some people who drink wine. You know, it's done. But here we do have different things. And but there's a little part of my disease, my immature, narcissistic thing. He goes, well, if they get to have that, I want to have that. And, well, you know what? They can eat one of those things. You know, I'm eating one and I'm thinking, when can I have the next one? You know, that's to me always the sign. If I'm eating something and thinking, gee, when am I going to have this again? It's probably, it is at least an orange food. It may not be a red, but it's severely orange. And so, like, for me, it came down to with this disease is I wanted to get better, and I knew I couldn't get better as long as food was an option. You know, part of it was like, and again, I shared this morning about, as long as I made food the option, I was like a rat going down a maze, the wrong thing of a maze, and getting to the wrong thing and banging my head against the end, and then backing out and running down the same damn one again. You know, I needed to try something different, which was just for today, I'm going to go through this. I'm going to deal with this. And I don't like that, because chances are if I want to eat, I'm in some kind of emotional pain. And I'm emotional pain a foe. I want anything except pain. You know, I somewhere got this weird idea growing up that I don't ever have to feel any kind of pain. But I heard, I forget who shared this at Serenity Sunday, something about the idea that you know, emotional pain is something of the, I can't remember the word right now, the you know, the furnace from which we grow, or the, you know, the thing that helps us grow. And it's certainly true that when I dealt with these things, it helped me get through them and out the other side. But as long as I kept going to the food, it's like being in a bad relationship and breaking up with the person and not dealing with whatever it is you're dealing with, and you end up in another relationship that's exactly the same, and you're going through the same stuff with that next person. Well, if you don't work through your own stuff, you're just going to keep doing it over and over. And it's sort of what I did with the food. You know, it was always an option, so therefore it was always going to be there. So how much time do I have?
5 minutes.
What? 5 minutes? Wow, how did I manage to not talk as much as I usually do? The other thing, I mean, that I got some good lessons when I came in. You know, I came into the other program first, but I mean, I'm really appreciative. This one guy who died, who I was a sponsor of, he was exactly like me. I mean, we were doppelgangers, saying a little sarcastic thing and everything. And, you know, he was 600 pounds. And I remember saying to him, Jim, the only difference between me and you is I came into AA first. I got slammed face down. I got to understand what it would take to get there. And I guarantee you, if I had not gotten into AA, I'd have been Jim. I'd have been the 600-pound guy, because I would have always been just smart enough. And that's what happens, I think, with this disease, especially if you're smart. Your brain keeps moving the goalposts. You keep saying, you know, you keep accepting what was previously unacceptable. I'll do this today. I'll never get to this number. If I get to this number, I'll do this or whatever. And to me, I don't think you can grow until you've got the food down totally. One of the things I would also do a lot of times, I would say, well, you know, I'm going to work on this. You know, again, my disease is always looking for a way to kick the can down the road. Well, I'll work on the spiritual part. I'll work on the steps. My disease wants it. Whatever it takes to keep you from actually putting the damn food down, you know. But I know, for me today, it had to start. Everybody's got different stories, I know. But for me, it had to start with being clean from the substance so that then I could move on, you know. I have friends and family that are in the mental health business, and they will, you know, an alcoholic comes in and he says he's drinking. They're going to tell him, you know, as soon as you got 30 days, come see me. Because they know there's going to be no real help if the person's still drinking. And I think the steps need to start. I mean, you know, that big book, every time I read it, even though it was never, you know, put in explicitly, I think there's an implicit thing of that should be in the front of the book. So obviously all this stuff is presupposing you put down the drink, you know, you put down the food. And the idea of getting down and working on the stuff, I think, relies on putting the food down. Now, that's a lot easier said than done, but I think it's to me the way it has, for me it had to work. I had to find a way, you know, to do that. And, you know, with my slip, I needed to change the way I saw things, you know. I, and yeah. What?
You
I am.
Yeah.
Gee, a minute ago you said 5 minutes, but okay. Anyway, so that's, and anyway, just to, I'll wrap up with the concept that I was powerless over this food, and also my life became a manageable. I love somebody once said, you flip it around, you know, I was powerless over life and my food became unmanageable, which is certainly true. But then I was left with this big gaping question of, okay, now what? If I'm powerless over food, what do I do? And that to me is where step one slides right to step two. There's a power greater than myself. It ain't me. So anyway, Robin, you want to take this back?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's have some milk for John here. I don't think I mentioned it. I put some paper with pens on the tables. You're going to have questions. There will be an ask a questionnaire seats thing. You want to write down what questions occur to you. Maybe Dr. Jones, feel free to take them. And we're glad you're here. I'm glad you're here. We'll have Seppi on step two.
Hi, I'm Seppi, compulsive overeater.
Hi, Seppi.
Hi. Oh, my God. That was amazing. I sure as hell needed to hear that. Thank you, John. I want to build on some of the stuff you said. You're absolutely right. I've been going to a lot of AA meetings. And the stories you know, and I'm only a compulsive overeater as far as I know. And it is amazing because, you know, they strip, they get thrown in jail, they throw up on themselves in public places. You know, these are the stories that I've heard, and it's exactly what you're saying. It's so dramatic. You're committed against your will. Your family does something, and ours is extremely different. You're very right. And you know, I don't want to think what I have is more difficult, but you just said it so beautifully. And it is a lot more cunning, baffling, and powerful. Thank you. That was just amazing. My story is a little different than John's. I came here, I think November 86, and I got abstinent in February 87. So I think I have 27. My math sucks. But I'm going to go straight into step two because, you know, by the time you get whipped, it is easy enough to say, yes, okay, now what? Exactly what he said, now what? And that's it. And I've done my steps on this 12 and 12, the AA 12 and 12, and I'm very traditionalist. And it's exactly how I felt, now what? Because I didn't believe in God. And I love step two. Step two, for me, in this book, really made all the difference. Because every original idea that I thought was mine really wasn't. Somebody had already addressed it in 1939. So it's like, oh, shit, there's nothing original about my logic. So I came from a family where any reliance on God... Am I on? Any reliance on God or any mention of God was for the uneducated masses. And then as I grew up, I wasn't quite so disdainful. Okay, fine, maybe there is a place for God. But surely, overeating is just because I don't have enough willpower. Again, somewhere in my mind, I could justify that God can help you with a chemical dependency. I get that. I get that if someone has the, you know, shakes or the DTs, maybe God can get them through. But I'm just a pig. That's the way I looked at it. Doesn't God really have anything more important to do than to help me with sugar and chocolate and donuts? It just did not make sense. But it talks about that. Now, one of the things I heard in one of the many AA meetings that I've been going to, which I love, is on the second page, it says, all of the 12 steps are but suggestions. And what I heard in the meeting is, we don't have any other suggestions. This is all there is. This is the only thing we have to give to you. So even though they're suggestions, that's it, babe. Then I started reading this book, and then the step, the description that got to me was when it talks about the intellectual one. And the intellectual one, you know, says if we are to really, really pride ourselves on being scientific, we have to look at the data. And that just, you know, it blew me out of the water. I had nothing to argue with anymore. So I had to concede that I was in the presence of people who had weighed a lot more than I did at my top weight. And I think my top weight was probably 35 pounds more than now. I've been 30 to 40 pounds more than now and probably 30 pounds less than now. And I had to say that I was with people who had weighed a lot more than I did, and somehow they'd managed to stay thin. And I could not refute that. And I had tried every diet. I had tried every therapist. I had tried every clinic. I had tried every fast. And somehow these people who were triple my size had managed to lose it and keep it off. There's no denying that, you know. And that's the thing that helped me start. Now, I don't know what you are. Maybe you are of the kind that you felt. And then I got to the other kind. But, you know, God, I used to pray to you when I was eating a 5-pound bag of M&Ms and say, please help me stop. And then as you get older in the program, you realize, well, not really. And this then talks about defiance. It's not that I wanted God to help me stop eating my 5-pound bag of M&Ms. I wanted to keep eating my 5-pound bag and not weigh anymore. That was the real, you know, it was like, okay, God, let me do what I want to do, but then please help me not pay the price. Mm-hmm. And I really believe in what John said. It's got to, I mean, anybody who's here and not abstinent, you know, we're grateful you're here. Better than you not being here. Mm-hmm. But the real recovery does start when you want to reach out for food and you don't. Mm. End of conversation. I had to stop having sugar. That's my thing. So when I started reading this, I remember the first time, 2 weeks into my abstinence, and my food is, problem is sugar. I've never binged on pizza or on steak or on bread. I have binged on Brussels sprouts though. You have too? And yeah, it's delicious for me now. But it was sugar. And I remember, I used to live in West Hollywood, and I'll never forget this. I went grocery shopping, and there was an aisle that had all of the chocolates and cookies. And it was right across from the aisle with all of the beers in the refrigerator. And I kept saying, God, please make me want that instead of this. And I really didn't. And then I was walking up and down, and I said, okay, if you are there, if there is such a thing that is going to help with food, which is not famine, but which is not a disease, which is not, you know, me losing my child, which is not a really serious problem, which I think God ought to come in. I just want my chocolate now. If you're there, this is it, buddy. Come on in. And I went up and down that aisle literally for 30 minutes. I kept putting the bag of M&Ms in my bag, putting it out. In my bag, putting it out. And finally, after 30 minutes, I walked out without purchasing that. And that's how it started for me. It was challenging God. Came to believe in a very challenging way. If you're there, this is your chance to prove yourself to me. Because, you know, I sure as hell don't know what the hell you are. And I sure as hell don't think you're going to help people who just, you know, like me, who eat too much. Help me. And that was, I had never been able to do that. It's that simple. Never, ever, when it struck that I needed my fix, that I've been able to not act on it. It comes, you act on it. Then my sponsor taught me, and so then I started, you know, it's just a smidgen of belief that it is possible that something that I'm really quite not sure is God is going to help me with not killing myself with food. And everything in my 27 years has been one iota of saying, okay, I really don't think you're going to catch me this time. Somehow this time it's going to be different, but I'm acting. And then somehow something miraculously happened, and I'm not destined to repeat the same thing that I have done before. then my sponsor said that part of what you do in step two, aside from writing on all of this stuff, is you actually define what you want in your higher power. Now, I hadn't been raised with a bad God. I was raised with no God. Mine wasn't punitive. I just didn't know what the hell it was. And I've heard people in the meetings with a lot of recovery saying, I want a God that loves me no matter what. I want a God that wants the best for me. You know, there were all these ethereal things that I couldn't understand. I just wanted God to make me skinny. That's all I did. I want you to make me skinny. I want to earn this much. I want to go to this party. I want to buy these clothes. That was my definition. And in the beginning, that's all I had. And it worked. I have no idea if I weighed that much or went to that party, whatever. But I'm saying I started off with what it says in second step, that I did look at God. I did define a Santa Claus at first. Mm-hmm. About the only spiritual thing on my list for my God, that he was going to help me not have sugar. That was the only spiritual thing. Everything else, I was treating him like Santa Claus. And over time, it got better. Now it's very different. One of the other things I want to talk about in this step, which I really didn't get the first time, was that we are defiant. I had no idea. I used to think I'm such a sweet, accommodating person. Again, with AA, it's very easy to identify anger. You destroy, you get angry, you blow things up. I thought myself to be sweet, accommodating, the whole world, you know, steps on me, poor me, this is why I eat. I don't have an iota of defiance in me. Everything about me is I want the rules of the world to not apply to me. I want to eat 10,000 calories a day and weigh what I weigh. I want to get the money I want without working the hours that go with it. I want to drive 100 miles an hour and not get a ticket. I want to have a red car and not have my insurance go up. It's as if, and it goes to your immaturity. And when you're first new, you don't hear any of this stuff. All you hear is my pants are tight, I ate too much, I had a loaf of bread. But you do come to understand all of this stuff is related. It is exactly what you said. I want what I want when I want it. And you make me wait, I'm not really going to be happy. And that was so humbling. At the end of this, when you go through all of this stuff, to understand exactly how scaredy you were and how I was, what a fearful person I was. All of the things that I thought I'm not, I am, and it was very, very humbling. But I didn't have to accept, I didn't have to swallow that in step two. But it's very, now, 27 years later, I see, okay, I want the outcome of my job to be this. Once again, I'm saying belief meant reliance, not defiance. Once again, I'm saying, God, I want you to make it this way. The only difference between me now and later and 27 years ago is that now I have so many instances to go back to where I didn't get what I wanted and the outcome was much better than what I had imagined for myself. But the DNA doesn't change. And when you're early in the program, this just means extra food. But John was right. It does not go away. When you put down the food, it's something else. It's a job. It's a person. It's a situation where you really think. And he's right. This is an extremely powerful thing. It helps you. It makes it think. Makes you think this is coming from God. But belief meant reliance, not defiance. Not saying, I don't like what is. Give it to me this way. And this was, on the one hand, this was the most difficult step for me to understand. Oh, this is even better. God grant me my wishes instead of thy will be done. It is so difficult to get that in the beginning because you don't know what you have to fall back on. That goes into step three. But it was very hard to say thy will be done. But what if thy will is for me to be a nun and forego all material things. What if thy will for me is to be an example of poverty and chastity and all sorts of things to teach away people something? Which then goes back to, you know, uniquely self-centered. None of this stuff makes sense to you when you're on step two. Step two is just really hard to believe, was for me, really hard to believe that God, which is there for big stuff, is going to help this pig put down donuts and M&M's. But he did. He addressed himself to me in much more trivial things. You know, then it started with, God, I'm going to go to my family's home. And they think, they refer to Alcoholics Anonymous as Assholes Anonymous. And they make my favorite Persian dishes with all of the fried rice just for me. God, you got to come in with me. I don't know how I'm not going to do it. And then somehow I've managed to just not have that. And this is how step two started working for me. And, Bob, and how much time do I have? Okay. The half. Can I give my 5.5 to Ira? Because
No.
Okay. Ira said no.
I got nothing to say.
Oh, God, that's going to be so loud on the CD. I really, really urge anyone who's having trouble with the idea of God, whether it is God helping you with food, whether it is because you think there is no God, whether you think you've already tried God and he didn't work, whether you think that there is no God. I actually went to an atheist AA meeting. It was very bizarre. And I kept thinking, why are all these people depressed? And then I looked at the, and Wayne and my husband and I went, and I'm like, well, this was a different meeting than anyone would have gone to. And then we're like, it says atheist. Ooh! But regardless, they hadn't had alcohol in several years. So I'm sure it's possible to not overeat without and remain an atheist. This really removes every argument you could possibly come up with. There was a guy, Richie, who used to say he started with his God being Magic Johnson.
Right.
And he really went through, that was the only thing that worked for him. Magic Johnson was his God. I had a friend who said she had had a hard upbringing, and it was really hard for her to consider God her higher power. And she referred to a table. There was a table in her mother's living room. She referred to that as her higher power. Really, if you read this and you read every sentence and you can understand English, you have nothing. You cannot argue with this. It does not leave you an out. There's an answer for every possible excuse you could come up with for why you can't do this. But I have to say, what you need to know is, and it really does get into step three, that he's not going to drop you. He, she, table, Magic Johnson, whatever, is not going to drop you. And I couldn't turn my food over as easily. I couldn't turn anything over as easily till I got more evidence that he's not going to drop me. And he does a much better job for me than I do. And I just take, you know, I can't expedite that feeling for you. You just have to trust that I don't lie to you, because I got better things to do on a Saturday afternoon. Okay, I really don't have anything else to say to just stay on step two, but this was really key for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a hand for Seppi.
Sure.
Okay, I think I'm nervous. I'll forget. We have t-shirts in back and the words are here for sale. Help yourself. Help you out. Then the water. And of course, step three, here's Simon.
Thanks, Ron. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ira, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hey, Ira.
And just to qualify, May 7th was 29 years and 8 months of abstinence and sobriety from Pacific Group.
Oh, God.
That's double
S. And I maintained about 140 to 144 pound weight loss for about 27 years. Yes. And just to show you how human I am, I forgot totally about this event. And Robin called me a half hour before. My first instinct is, why'd you wait till a half hour? Till he pointed out to me that he reminded me six times. However, we're human, you know. And the way I learned, first of all, I've had to write on all the steps. And I learned a lot of stuff from my AA sponsor as well. All my sponsors have been AA people as well as my current spiritual advisors, both AA and OA. And he's been my sponsor for 28 years, and he's engaged. He's 83 years old, and he's engaged. And that's to get her off his back. But one of the first things, there are a couple of things. One of the first things that I heard from a guy named Vern W. at a, it was about step three, and he had cancer, and actually he was terminal, and he was very uncomfortable and didn't want to share. It was a men's stag, and he said basically the third step is you do what you're told. There's another thing my friend Ken, who's also from the Valley, says, and this is something I think that is an issue for us in Overeaters Anonymous, which is that you cannot sell this, you have to experience it. You know, you have to experience it. Like Seppi was talking about, that one moment where you want to eat something real bad and you don't do it. That's where the power comes from. You know, in all of the literature, you know, it talks about the great reality is deep within us. And also this idea about things, nothing is ever perfect until we're done. Among the things I've had to deal with in September 2009, I was diagnosed with MS, and I still work out. I just had surgery that was a painful surgery, and health was never an issue for me. I mean, I'm Mr., you know, like I work out, I'm all that stuff. Aside from relationships and chapter 13 and stuff, and I'm getting, and here's the ultimate third step experience. Okay, I was asked by one of our fellows who I respect very well, that the West Coast, at least in terms of Overeaters Anonymous World Service, is not represented. So there were a couple of us, me and Hannah, were asked, would you like to run for trustee, General Service Trustee? And that was not my instinct. It's like, I'm not feeling good, I don't want to do it, but I'll do it. You know, and I talked to my sponsor, Marty, who said, it's like you see the most beautiful girl at the dance, and you're absolutely convinced she's going to say no, but at least you get to ask. Mm-hmm. So I did. I went through the whole thing, went to Albuquerque, and this is third step stuff, because I really physically was not really up for it. But I did, and I did a good presentation, and my worst fear was realized, which was there were two people who ran. There were four of us. And all of us have had a lot of time and a lot of experience. Two positions, four people running, and I finished dead last, at least 50 votes. You know, I think there was 200 votes altogether. It was, one could call it humiliating. You know, but here's where the third step comes in. Some people who were supportive of me, I mean, it wasn't like I got no votes. They also hadn't seen me for 8 years. They could have, you know, there are a lot of reasons when you get out of the way, it's not personal. But they started bad-mouthing. A couple of the people said they shouldn't have ran this, and I stopped. I said, wait a minute, these are good people. These are good people. You know, in other words, I wouldn't engage in the gossip, and it would have been easy to do it. My wife says it this way. She's 15 years old. She says you have to fight for the right to be uncomfortable. Mm. You know, my food is not perfect. I mean, here, like an example, I call my food in every day. And I'm not always honest about it. 100%. I had some mushrooms and hummus along with the squash that I had yesterday and didn't tell them, but I told them today. And the reason is, I view that as a manifestation of turning it over in the sense that I'm afraid he's going to fire me, I'm afraid he's going to get mad at me, all of that stuff. I don't want to have to be, you know, pay for my consequences of my actions, all that stuff. You know, there is a saying, you can't be too dumb for this program, some of us are too goddamn smart. You know, I also heard about a higher power, and this reduces it down to probably its simplest component. I heard of an AA meeting once. The only thing you have to be concerned about, in order to be successful at Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing you have to be concerned about a higher power is to be reasonably clear you're not it. That's it. That's it. It can be anything but you. Anything. Do we have a big book? There's something in it that I think may be germane. Also, so what I learned was you bring the body, the mind will follow. It doesn't work, at least for me, it doesn't work the other way around. What do we say? You can act your way into good thinking, you can't think your way into good acting. Because I'm using the same thing that tells me the chocolate's a vegetable to decide the course of my life for the rest of it. You know? And
can
you
hold it?
No, it's cool. Let's see. So on page 18, which is in There Is a Solution, this to me is the dilemma for us. And it relates to step three, because in order to do step three, I have to manifest this with another human being. One of the other things, with that AA sponsor, it was 7 years before we discovered, and I was doing everything I was told, that we had a sponsor relationship. In other words, we, one Saturday afternoon, you know what, this is a sponsor relationship. And I had been sober and I've done the steps, I've done them several ways. I think we make too much of that issue. I don't believe find somebody who has what you want, because when I'm nuts, everybody has what I want, nobody has what I want. So what I tell people is find somebody you can talk to. That's what's important. So what it says here, John, can you give me to 18?
Thank you.
Thank you. If you relate to this, and there's actually some italics in the big book, what it says, and this is, again, I come from the perspective of being a 100-pounder, very angry. My high weight was around 325 to 330. My driver's license lied, and it said that I was 5'11", when I've never been over 5'6 and a half. And getting shorter every day. Okay, on 18 it says, highly competent, this is in the middle of the page, highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us find it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic, or in our case a compulsive overeater, or bulimic, to discuss his or her situation without reserve, in other words, telling the complete truth. Right? Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. Even in the program. Then, here's the italics. And generally when the big book says italics, and the only reason I know this is I was told to read 2 pages a day, reread it, put it down. And I was doing what I was told. That was a third step thing. It says, but the ex-problem drinker or overeater who has found this solution was properly armed with facts about him or herself can generally win, this is the whole point, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. And here's the joke, and this is why I think we have so much problems. It says, until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That's what the manifestation for me of the third step is. It's where I talk to somebody and I say, help. I have to do this physically. I can't figure it out in my head. And it's easy to be spiritual in a room like this. You know, where we're not arguing and we're all here and we all want to do this. And you guys, it's great to turn out. And I almost forgot. And my first instinct with Robin was to say, I can't make it. Because I've got a deadline to do. I've got this. And then I realized, and I was looking at the For Today, where it talks about how we can do service. You know. And the right thing was to come down here. And it was amazing. I live in Calabasas. So I have to turn over the 101 and the 405 South to my higher power. And both of them moved.
Wow.
And I left my house in Calabasas at around 25 minutes to one. It was here by 107.
Wow.
right.
And that's without, I mean, driving like a maniac.
Moses does.
Most of the time. Anyway, there's one other thing, too, that I want to get to on page 69.
Oh, my God, you know all the pages.
The only reason I know this stuff is I've been told to read two pages, and he voted the other one, and the OA stuff.
59?
Yeah. Now, here's, this is one of my favorite readings, and I think this relates to step three, where it talks about willingness. You don't have to want to do it, you just have to be willing to do it. You don't have to like giving up chocolate, but if chocolate's killing you. In fact, that guy who became my AA sponsor one time, I'm in the entertainment business. I write music for film and all that kind of stuff. And I think there should be a 12-step program for that. These people are too defiant. He said, "How are you doing, Iron?" This is when I was in my first marriage, toward my high weight, and I was doing work and very serious and dark and all that. And he said, "I'm doing just fine, Joe." And he said, "Well, if you're doing..." Now, this is a guy who was not an overeater. He says, "If you're doing so well, why do you keep trying to kill yourself?" See, so that's where I come from. And, of course, I surrendered immediately, and 4 years later came to my first meeting. Okay, so here's what it says. Now, this is the reading is in step five, but it relates about why and how it relates to me to step three is about why I've got to check this stuff out physically with somebody else. It says, how can we be certain we had made a true catalog of our defects and really admitted them even to ourselves? Because we were still bothered by fear, self-pity, and hurt feelings, it was probable we couldn't appraise ourselves fairly at all. Okay? And then it talks about guilt and remorse or anger. Then it says in the second paragraph on 59 of the AA 12, "Well, hence, it was most evident that solitary self-appraisal and the admission of our defects based upon that alone wouldn't be nearly enough. We had to have outside help if we were surely to know and admit the truth about ourselves, the help of God and another human being." Now, I know it's talking about step five, but the step three part of it is the willingness to participate like that, like what Seppi was talking about, like what John was talking about. You cannot do this yourself. I can't. Okay? And only by discussing ourselves, holding back nothing, only by being willing, there's willingness again, to take advice and accept direction could we set foot on the road to straight thinking, solid honesty, and genuine humility. So it's only by accepting help. It doesn't say you can accept help and then figure it out yourself. It says only by accepting help. Then it says, yet many of us still hung back. We said, why can't God, as we understand Him, tell us where we are astray? If the Creator gave us our lives in the first place, then He must know in every detail where we have since gone wrong. Why don't we make our admissions to Him directly? Why do we need to bring anyone else into this? Now this is for me what's most significant about the literature, God, my relationship with it, the universe, Overeaters Anonymous, why I'm here, as opposed to what it used to be like when I tried to run my own life. At this stage, the difficulties of trying to deal rightly with God and by ourselves are twofold. Though we may be at first, oops, too far. Startled to realize that God knows all about us, we are apt to get used to that quite quickly. Somehow being alone with God doesn't seem as embarrassing as facing up to another person, like the food. Like, I had mushrooms and hummus, and I'm afraid to tell somebody. See? And I can tell you that I'm cunning enough where I told you that truth, but I won't tell you about the other thing. You know, that kind of stuff. You know. Until we actually sit down and talk aloud about what we have so long hidden, our willingness to clean house is still largely theoretical. When we are honest with another person, it confirms that we have been honest with ourselves and with God. Now here's the greatest, especially for OA. The second difficulty is this. What comes to us alone may be garbled by our own rationalization and wishful thinking. Maybe. It may not be, but then again it may be. The benefit of talking to another person is that we can get his direct comment and counsel on our situation, and there can be no doubt in our minds what that advice is. Now this is what I think the essence of like what OA can be, and in my experience, where people hurt themselves more than anywhere else. Going it alone in spiritual matters is dangerous. How many times have we heard well-intentioned people claim the guidance of God when it was all too plain that they were sorely mistaken? Lacking both practice and humility, they had deluded themselves and were able to justify the most errant nonsense on the ground that this was what God told them. Mm-hmm. It is worth noting that people of very high spiritual development almost always insist on checking with friends or spiritual advisors the guidance they feel they have received from God. Surely then, a novice ought not lay himself open to the chance of making foolish, perhaps tragic, blunders in this fashion. While the comment or advice of others may be by no means infallible, it is likely to be far more specific than any direct guidance we may receive while we are still inexperienced in establishing contact with a power greater than ourselves. That's why I can't do this while I'm a sponsor. That's why turning it over means I talk to another human being. Because this is a physical world, folks. I've been very blessed. OA has given me everything, including the ability to have dignity when I lost in front of 200 people. I got 2 minutes. It's given me everything. And I'm here because I have to give something back. And for me, what the change, you know, a lot of people say progress, not perfection. That's not what it says in the book. It says spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. My problem is that I'm very self-centered. I want what I want and screw everybody else. You know, give me, and don't let the door hit you on the way out. You know, right? So what spiritual progress is my willingness to help somebody else and to share my experience. That's the other thing. If you have a problem with something that somebody tells you to do, you have the right, every one of us, to say, what's your experience with this? Sponsors are not authorities. They're just people who we share our experience, strength, and hope. Not opinions, not diets. I'm not here to teach a class in Overeaters Anonymous. That's all we have. And since it's anonymous, that means that if I'm sponsoring you and you have an issue with something, what you get to ask me is, what was it like for you? And if I do my job and I tell you, then what happens is, then maybe you'll get the confidence to do something you're scared to do. That's how I see the third step. I'm glad to be here, and no pizza afterwards. Bye.
Let's go about 2:30, 25-minute break or so.
Order a journal, write your questions.
Yeah, it goes
back
to free.
Anything else? 25 minutes.
I've got a strange deadline. I'm going to Shanghai.
Oh, the real quick.